Hello, I'm Nicholas Barrett.
Hello, I'm Georg Zachman.
Hello, I'm Ben McWilliams.
And Gabriel Philomel.
And you're listening to The Sound of Economics. Now, if the European Green Deal is going to succeed in cutting emissions to a state that leaves us climate neutral by 2050 and 40% less carbon emissions over the next 10 years, it's probably going to involve some kind of carbon tax. But what happens if industry simply exports or outsources a lot of those carbon-intensive activities to countries beyond Europe's border? How will we react to that? One solution is a carbon border tax that takes those into account. And soon we're going to be discussing whether that's a good idea or not. But first, Ben, tell us a little bit about what happened in Brussels this week.
So the big news in Brussels this week was that the European Commission has launched its climate law. This is something that has been discussed now for a year or so. The European Parliament and the European Council have both approved the general concept, but this week was the first time that we've seen the real legislative proposal. So it's essentially putting the concept and the main idea behind the European Green Deal into law. Ursula von der Leyen described it as the compass looking forward for Europe, and that's kind of what it is. It gives us a net target for 2050, but it doesn't say so much about how we'll get there. To read from it a bit, it talks about union-wide emissions and removals of greenhouse gases should be balanced at the latest by 2050. The interesting things here are that it's union-wide, so what this means is that it's not on a country level, so by 2050 some countries can still be emitting more carbon than they absorb, perhaps Sweden, whereas other countries who are a little bit more sceptical and have resisted shifts in this direction, perhaps Poland, will be able to still emit carbon. And the other interesting element is that this is net emissions. So it's net emissions, which will be zero by 2050, which means we can still there'll still be countries emitting carbon at source, but other carbon sinks, so trees or peat, will be removing carbon, or perhaps technological solutions taking it out of the air.
So a carbon sink is an area that holds a lot of carbon, like a forest, for instance.
Exactly. So there'll still be carbon emissions, but at the same time there'll be carbon being withdrawn from the air, either from agricultural or trees, and at the same time, perhaps by technological solutions.
Maybe if I may add, one interesting additional point is that it's about greenhouse gas emissions. So it's not about CO2 only, but it's about greenhouse gas emissions. And if you look into the figures, kind of reducing net greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 is much more ambitious than reducing just CO2 emissions by 2050. The target would essentially boil down. So typically, having net CO2 emissions to zero by 2050 would essentially mean something in the 2060s of having a greenhouse gas target of zero. So we are kind of moving that goalpost significantly forward. So the target is not unambitious.
And it involves sectors that have been very far from recent policymaking, for example, agriculture, where a lot of non-CO2 greenhouse gases are emitted, and it would also mean bringing housing and traffic into legislation, which until now has been under the competence of member states. So there's a big issues that arise here, and as far as I understand, there's no clear plan yet. We have the objectives and the ambition, but how to go there is very much uncertain, yes.
So I'm just going to gauge how we're all feeling about the European Green Deal, how optimistic we are. So Gabriel, it's obviously very nice for you to join us. We're very lucky to have you, but how are you feeling about the European Green Deal at the moment? Are you feeling good about it, or are you worried about the kind of obstacles it's going to face in the years and perhaps decades to come?
Yeah, so I have very mixed feelings, actually. So I think it is important to be ambitious in Europe. If not Europe is ambitious here, who else? No, but there are still so many open questions. It's good to have ambitious objectives, but it would be even better to have credible pathways towards meeting those objectives, and we don't have them yet. The fear that I have is that we have, the climate right now in Europe is we have the Fridays for Future. There is some sort of consensus. We need to deal something. We need to do something because the young generation is upset. But maybe in the next recession, all these concerns are swept away by others that are maybe more important. So I fear a bit, you know, that this enthusiasm that we have right now dies away as fast as it has come.
Yeah, Ben, with the coronavirus on the horizon now, there are fears that there could be a recession this year. Do you think if there is a kind of financial crisis, then things like the European Green Deal could become collateral damage?
It's definitely a worry. Actually, Timmermans this week, kind of his perception on the climate law was that this is the reason why it's so important is because it locks this ambition, or it will lock this ambition in legally for the European Union. As long as it's all talk and there's nothing legally on the table, then exactly a recession arising for whichever reason, coronavirus, economic downturn, can lead to climate being put on the shelf, put back. It moves down the list of priorities. Maybe to echo a bit, Gabriel's points also on the Green New Deal, that it has this big ambition for the future, but it's not yet clear exactly how we'll get there. That's, again, one of the criticisms that the environmentalists and Greta Thunberg, who is in town this week, have kind of posed to this new climate law, with the big problem being that this 2030 target, so by 2030 we're supposedly reducing emissions 40%, and this is still postponed and it's still only coming later in the year. So this gives us a nice ambition for 2050, but it's not so clear yet how we get there, and always the argument will be the emissions that we can reduce right now and the incremental steps that we can take are much more important than having a big law in place for the future. That being said, it's still a very positive step.
Georg, how are you feeling about the European Green Deal as a whole right now?
I think it's in principle a nicely designed political project because it takes everybody kind of on board. It's kind of as a subject that most Europeans agree are important. Voters have voted in the direction of environmental policy. It focuses the minds of member states and officials in Brussels. It's very cross-sectoral. So as a European project, it has both domestic and external implications. So it helps a bit to create new motivation and momentum for the European project in a time where multilateralism is in difficult times. The main challenge that I see is that kind of by coming up with a flagship project like that, the hope would be to put it really on the top of the agenda of the coming years, and that's exactly where your question comes on. Will these sorts of questions now be on the agenda of the next summits, and will kind of the heads of state and government in Europe negotiate horse trade on the big questions, or will it all be left again to the ministers that have their very narrow interests in German car industry or French nuclear industry or Danish agricultural industry? And if it's going to get down to the level of ministers still, then it's very difficult to find the compromises that are needed. So this prioritization is the right one, but the question is whether the Commission will manage to keep it as high on the agenda as I would say it is needed.
So let's move on to the carbon border tax. Now, as I was saying in my preamble to the podcast, if Europe is going to achieve these goals, it's going to have to burn less carbon within the European Union, at least. But, of course, this is a global problem. It's a global system, the climate. So it's possible that multinational firms and just supply chains in general will be incentivized to burn their carbon in Asia or perhaps in Africa or perhaps in America. And one possible solution to that that's been floated and may become part of the European Green Deal is the carbon border tax that taxes items coming into the European Union according to how carbon intensive their production was elsewhere. Now, Ben and Georg have written a paper that is critical of this idea. Georg, why don't you explain what this idea is and why you are skeptical about it?
Well, carbon border adjustment mechanism, as it's called by the European Commission, has been an idea that is around for 20 years, and it's not only around in Europe but also beyond Europe. The idea is essentially that incoming carbon embedded in product is facing an additional tax when it enters into Europe in order to make sure that European producers of the same product that fall under European carbon pricing are not treated worse than their foreign competitors. And it has essentially two implications. One is kind of from a domestic competitiveness perspective, it's to support the industry, and on an environmental perspective, which I guess is the more important one, the problem is if in Europe we are reducing CO2 emissions, but essentially the same emissions pop up outside of the European Union, potentially in addition to transport emissions, to bringing then the dirty steel to Europe, then nothing would have been gained by strong and costly European policies. So that is the general motivation for it. In our paper, Ben and I have been arguing that the evidence for actual leakage in the past has not been very convincing, so that a lot of the carbon pricing mechanisms that we observe did not produce significant carbon leakage, that essentially Europe continues to be an industrial powerhouse despite its carbon pricing mechanisms and environmental protection. And that, on the other hand, all the tools that one would have to introduce to make such a carbon border adjustment functional are extremely costly and difficult to do. Because what ideally you would want to do is you would want to understand for each toy, for each piece of electronics that you import into Europe, what is the carbon associated in producing exactly that thing. And that requires to essentially scan the entire value chain. And it's highly complex to do so. There's a lot of intermediate solution. I mean, there are now books being written with hundreds of pages on the detailed implementation of the thing and the different options that are available. But in general terms, I think one of the crucial points is the complexity of capturing the entire value chain in such a system.
Gabriel, would a carbon border tax be a huge bureaucratic nightmare?
That depends very much on how it is implemented, as Georg said. It is indeed a challenge to measure the tax base appropriately. We want to tax the carbon content of imports, and for that we would need to be sure about the carbon content of imports. And we would probably also have to exempt the exporters so that they are not disadvantaged when they export to another country. And for that, we would need to have the carbon content as well. Now, the question is how good one could measure that. I think in certain industries, it's not a big issue. So, for example, in the chemicals industry, we know about the reactions that are in place, how much energy is needed, and it's relatively easy to see through that, despite the fact that there are thousands and thousands of chemical products. Same is true for steel or other base metals, where there is heterogeneity. I mean, you can't produce steel without electricity or with coal, with different CO2 emissions associated to that, but it's relatively large scale. It's not that we have thousands and thousands of producers, and it's very homogeneous products. If you want to know the carbon contents of a car, that is very, very complicated. So that's why the Commission is pushing for a solution that's targeted to certain sectors. And I can understand why that's the case, because there are sectors where carbon leakage is very minor, but where measuring the carbon content would be very, very complicated. And so that's one line where I think compromises will be found. But everything really depends on how smart we are. I think there are ideas around in the literature to make foreign producers reveal voluntarily the carbon content of their output. We need to incentivize them. So economists call this mechanism design. There's big literature out there. Or we do see there's a lot of private sector interest in understanding the carbon footprint of goods. So those who sell shoes or electronics or whatever it is, they want to be able to tell their customers how much carbon there is. Increasingly, they also have to tell their investors. So it's not just for the carbon border adjustment mechanisms that we will be interested in the carbon footprint of goods, but for other reasons as well. And so I'm relatively optimistic that if we invest the right energy into that, if we are innovative, if we use technologies like the blockchain, then we can manage that so that it doesn't become a bureaucratic monster.
Ben, a proposal being complicated has never stopped the European Union doing anything in the past. Why should it stop it doing something now?
I think in our paper we have two arguments, two joint arguments. One, that on the one hand it's very complicated, and then the other, that the problem it's looking to address is not necessarily as big as it might be made out to be in the public conversation. And at the same time, there are other alternatives that can be introduced which are significantly less complicated and don't run into all of these problems. In terms of the Commission not being able to introduce something complicated, we actually have a similar example of something that was tried like this just a few years ago. So under the ETS, which sets the carbon price in Europe, the European Commission wanted to include aviation from international airports into this scheme. And in 2013, they had a proposal to include this. So it would mean that if you take off in New York and land in Berlin, as an air provider, you have to pay for the carbon you emit over the course of the whole flight. And after working out all the legislation and talking through this, they got ready to implement it. And on the day they were going to implement it, there was a phone call from China who complained against this and weren't happy with this. And they essentially threatened to cancel 13 billion orders in Airbus planes. So there was this retaliation from political partners against a scheme similar to the one that we see now. And then the problem came that the European Union was not so committed to it. You have different interests within Europe. Germany, for instance, and France were, of course, worried about the loss in sales of Airbus, and the proposal was scrapped. And again, here we see that it's very complicated, and perhaps the Commission can indeed work out over the next year or so, as they will try to do so, a mechanism, see how it works. It will be very complicated, and there'll be trade-offs between how complicated it is and how feasible it is. But at the end of the day, it's still going to be strongly opposed by political partners. And given that there are some voices in the European Union not so keen for this, it's hard to see how it will fly on the international scene when it comes to finally being proposed.
Gabriel, is there a danger that what the European Union perceives as an important environmental check will be perceived by our trading partners around the world as protectionism? An excuse for protection.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is the danger, of course. It's very easy to see how the current U.S. president would hate that. I think it will be very important for the European Commission to find allies in this. We're not the only region in the world that has ambitious climate policies. We're not the only ones who have carbon prices. Canada, Australia, parts of the United States, China maybe down the road, and who knows what happens next year, who will be the next president in the U.S. So I think there are, what is very important is that that Europe engages into climate diplomacy and uses that. That is more important than turning Europe into a climate fortress, as some say. It's also important to see in this entire context that the bigger challenge that we face is not so much that there is leakage in the goods markets, but the bigger challenge is really that we have what we call indirect leakage. And Georg and Ben have pointed it out in their paper that emissions might go up in other countries because the price for fossil fuels goes down when Europe reduces its demand for that, and that has nothing to do with goods markets or goods market competition. That's on the energy market. So, and to deal with that, what we need is to convince as many countries as possible to join a climate coalition, as Bill Nordhaus, a Nobel Prize winning economist, has asked for. And maybe that's my view, is that with a cleverly designed border adjustment mechanism, we can, also encourage others like the United States to join us, because the Americans have in the past thought about carbon pricing and it always had a border adjustment mechanism in there. If we Europeans can show them that it works and that we have some clever ideas how to make it work, then it might also work for others and make it easier for this climate club to come about. We could also help developing countries, for example, if we collect revenue from imposing their exports to us, to carbon pricing, we can rebate that to them and say, look, here is, we tax our own consumers, essentially, and use those proceeds to finance projects, research and development or investment projects in countries where those goods are actually produced. So there are many ways to deal with this threat of protectionism. Let's be clever and let's take this serious, and then we'll find ways.
Georg, we're coming to an end, but I'll give you the last word on this. Should we be more ambitious?
Maybe you allow me quickly to react to Gabriel, and because I have a question. I really like the idea of this carbon clubs, and I think if we are able to build something up like that with a carbon border adjustment mechanism for a large group of countries, that seems a sensible longer term strategy. But for that we need partners, and I was wondering kind of if we now go ahead, we design mechanism A, which is completely different from what the U.S. might be able to come up in the next legislative period. Is there not a risk that we essentially kind of go for would it not make much more sense to develop something jointly when they're ready for it, instead of now going ahead designing something that fits the European institutional environment perfectly but does not fly at all with a corresponding U.S. environment?
I mean, if we lived in a perfect world, we would have carbon pricing everywhere, and that's it. No, we're not in this situation. But Europe and the United States share one important common feature. We are both net importers of carbon. No? So the imports of the U.S. and of Europe contain more carbon than our exports to other countries. And that means that we should actually, in principle, have very similar interests. No? We have seen the Americans in the last tax reform, when it came to taxing profits, applying very similar principles, not to apply what is called destination-based cash flow taxation. That's theoretically very similar to the carbon border adjustment. So I'm not too skeptical, but it's of course always good to start discussing now, and it's always good to seek international cooperation rather than putting up something that's a provocation for others. I think that's easy to say. Like to push the Commission to take this very serious.
Great, that works for me because I have to be at the Berlin one in 10 minutes, so I have to run. But if you want to read this paper, it's called A European Carbon Tax, Much Pain, Little Gain, and it's available on Bruegel.org. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much to my guests. It's been really interesting.